Hi, and welcome to the Vancouver Life Podcast.
This podcast is created to answer the most talked about questions when it comes to navigating the Vancouver real estate market.
I'm your host, Dan Wortel, a licensed agent and accredited real estate investment advisor based here in Vancouver, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ryan Dash.
Hi, Dan. I'm also a local realtor, an exhausted father of two, husband of one, and really happy to be here.
Let's get right into today's episode.
The federal budget was announced this week, and it had a major, major focus on housing. And in this episode, we are going to break down this announcement for you and how it will affect housing in Canada over the next 7 years. On top of this, the March inflation numbers came out, and while it rose slightly, there were some more encouraging numbers when you peeled back the curtain. So we're going to get into all this and provide an update on the expected rate cuts and how much they may or may not even affect the housing needle moving forward in 2024. And as we break down this federal budget for you and its effect on housing, if you hear something that affects you and your housing decisions directly, well, feel free to reach out and book a consultation with us. We'd be happy to explore how you can best capitalize on your decision. So let's get into first the inflation information that just came out for March. And yeah, it rose. It hit 2.9%, up from 2.8% back in February. This was largely expected, and the rise or the increase was basically on the back of increasing gasoline prices. However, the big surprise in this week's data was the continued fall of the Bank of Canada's preferred measures of core inflation, because both median and CPI trim were not only down on a 12-month basis, but fell to well under 2% when measured on a 3-month basis, and to just over 2% when measured on a 6-month basis. So not only is core inflation falling, but it has become more and more clear that inflation in Canada is almost entirely a shelter-driven phenomenon. Shelter costs remain the major driver of inflation here in Canada. For example, mortgage interest costs up 24.5% and rent up 8.5% year over year. Big, big numbers, and obviously contribute heavily to that CPI basket. When we exclude it, when we take shelter out of it, consumer prices just rose 1.5% year over year. 1.5%. So if Canada is looking for a case to lower its policy rate at the next announcement on June the 5th, well, this report provided ample evidence in support of that move. But obviously not a guaranteed home run that they will be cutting, right? Because BOC, the Bank of Canada, is still in a very interesting position. I mean, sure, they lower rates. Well, the shelter inflation number should also lower with it. But of course, pretty good chance if you lower the overnight rate, you're going to start to stimulate housing overall again and get some more fire into that marketplace. But maybe not as many or as many transactions that could have happened should they have lowered back in early 2024. Because you got to think at this point, like we mentioned, the next cut may happen in early June, and that's entering an already slower season. And that cut's probably only 0.25%. So not a major impact, understandably. But do remember that people buy on sentiment largely, right? Yes, of course, lower rates fuel the buying power. But, you know, here we are in a 5% overnight rate, and we've been here for almost 10 months now. And yet, property prices in Vancouver have gone up for the last 2 months, with condo prices sitting at an all-time high. So sentiment can also play a big part in driving real estate prices, not just rates. There's no singular factor, obviously, but again, 5% rate, all-time high condo prices, something to consider. So sentiment is higher now, and that's pushed those prices up for the last 2 months. And well, as always, we will see, but we're going into a bit of a positive dynamic here. But of course, the federal budget may sway things, as there is a lot of information in this one. And again, it's primarily on housing, and we're going to start to break that down for you now.
Yeah, to pull some of that, pull the curtain back even further, as you mentioned, Dan, there's been a major focus on housing with this particular budget, with $8.5 billion out of the $53 billion allocated to housing spending over the next 5 years. So Chrystia Freeland introduced the budget by saying, this is a fair chance to build a good middle-class life, to do as well as your parents or better. That's the promise of Canada. For too many, especially for younger Canadians, that promise is at risk. We have a plan to fix that. We have a plan to build a Canada that works better for you, where you can get ahead, where your hard work pays off, where you can buy a home, where you can have a fair chance at a good middle-class life. First, we're building more affordable homes because the best way to make home prices more affordable is to increase supply and quickly. That's where we're cutting red tape and reforming zoning. We're building more apartments and affordable housing across the country and unlocking public lands and vacant government offices to build homes for Canadians. Okay. I don't know if they're finally hearing the message, but I think as we start to peel some of this back, there's going to be some promises and then there's going to be some realities. So let's kind of look at that. Without a doubt, housing is at the forefront of this budget. It's a huge piece of it, and rightfully so. Housing has become unattainable for so many people. I should also mention that some of where they said here, or where Chrystia Freeland said, a fair chance to build a good middle-class life, to do as well as your parents or better, and that promise is at risk. You know, it would be fair to say that it's possible they created that risk as well. But anyhow, with home ownership that's more expensive than ever, with rents at all-time highs, how do they expect, and how are we going to explore the actual feasibility of these promises? Well, Budget 2024 and Canada's housing plan lay out the government's bold strategy to unlock 3.87 million homes by 2031, which includes a minimum of 2 million net new homes on top of the 1.87 million homes expected to be built anyways by 2031. Well, let's go fact check some of this. 1.87 million homes by October 2031 would mean Canada is building 267,000 homes per year. The all-time high ever recorded consistently was back in the 70s, 1974, at 274,000. And since then, Canada has averaged around 205,000 homes for the last 5 years. Per year, I should say. Where is this additional 30% going to come from? And then on top of that, we're adding 2 million more. Well, suddenly that jumps to 552,000 homes per year, double the all-time high best year. I just don't see how that's feasible, considering the amount of qualified people we have to build those homes. We just don't have the tradespeople. And City Hall and the bureaucratic process to build a home, as we know, takes so long. So then what happens to material construction costs when we start demanding all of these materials to build all of these homes? Well, you're going to have a shortage of materials, and that's going to push up the price. So we'll see how much the government likes doing a developer's job here and see if they end up passing the cost down, which of course they will, and that will in effect create potentially more unaffordable homes. Keep in mind, building en masse, a condo tower, for example, with 350 homes inside can take here in Vancouver upwards of 7 years to go from conception to closed doors. So you can basically rule out those as part of any additional homes as part of this plan. It's really to focus on the missing middle. Rezoning will help. But can we expect to see 500,000 fourplexes in the next 7 years? All of it sounds a bit unicorns and rainbows, and this is also assuming that nothing is going to go wrong with supply chains in the next 7 years and that everything's just going to be built the way it should be. And we know, having gone through the last 4 years, the last 8 years, it's full of unknowns. And that is a huge question mark around these promises.
It seems that there's a lot of good intent within this plan, but intent is not always execution. And so, sure, it's very easy to strike the pen and say, yeah, this is what we have plans for. But it often feels like these are not thought out or properly discussed or advised on by people within the profession. Because like you mentioned, Ryan, doubling the rate of home completions in a calendar year, I mean, the amount of workers alone makes this essentially insurmountable. So we will see how this pans out. They actually do have a couple ideas on how to help bring trades into the country. But again, this is a slow moving industry. You don't just double the amount of construction overnight. It's impossible. So it's going to be a ramp up But again, just say what? We're going to ramp up from where we are today throughout 7 years. And by 7 years, we need to do 3-4 times the all-time record completions. It just seems like a bit of a pipe dream or a fantasy, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt, shall we? And let's dissect this a little further, including their accelerator fund. You've maybe already heard about this one. This they have $4 billion allocated to, with the intent to help bring 750,000 homes to market. Wait a minute, $4 billion sounds like a big number, but so does 750,000. I mean, if you break that down per home, that's an allocation of only $5,300 per home. Like, how much accelerant are you throwing on that fire to get a home built? I mean, that barely pays for the gas to get the trades to the property for the first couple of months here. So let's move along. There's another $40 billion through the Apartment Construction Loan Program, which is providing low-cost financing to build more than 101,000 new rental homes across Canada. Okay, this I am 100% behind. Building homes takes a lot of money. And what puts a lot of developers on the sidelines is high interest rates. We've seen it, we're living it today. So with a government plan to provide builders with access to low-cost financing will result in homes being built, for sure. Right now, this is only for rental homes. So should they also do this to basically end-user homes? Of course they should, absolutely. Call it a, I don't know, 1% or 0.5% construction loan in perpetuity. Something like that would have an early and significant impact on the amount of homes being built. Next up, they've got another $14 billion through the Affordable Housing Fund to build 60,000 new affordable homes and repair 240,000 additional homes. Okay, great, exactly. So here we are funding new homes. The repair thing, great. Okay, we're not allowed to do it, remember, because we get taxed. So finally, the government's doing it. And again, they're not going to tax themselves. So at least somebody's going to fix those homes that should be more livable. Moving on once again here, they're unlocking an additional $20 billion in new financing to build 30,000 more rental apartments per year by increasing the annual limit for Canada mortgage bonds from $40 billion up to $60 billion. Again, this is more money being put towards rental apartments, which we need as well, right? That's an incredibly tight market. And anyone who's in the rental market, and definitely in Ontario or definitely BC, you are feeling that. And if you have more choice, then rental rates go down. So in essence, these are all largely good ideas. They're not perfect, but they're definitely a move in the right direction, I feel. This is ultimately incentivizing the supply instead of taxing the demand. Finally, this is what's important, right? We've seen them tax the demand for at least the last 8 years and create another new tax and another new tax. I think we're up to 7 right now. And prices are still going up and they're near all-time highs. So that clearly does not work. Now, this is positive in my opinion, because again, they're finally focusing on supply and not demand. So we will see how impactful this shift actually is over the next number of years.
Your comment about $5,300 per home with the $4 billion housing accelerator fund only paying for gas really made me chuckle, considering the carbon tax that we're going to add to that cost. But anyhow, moving on from that, I think, Dan, what you mentioned with respect to the intentions, I think you're, like you said, they're great, but let's not forget that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And today, governments across Canada are sitting on a surplus of underused and vacant public land, such as empty office towers, low-rise buildings, all of which that could be built on. By unlocking these lands for housing, governments can lower the cost of construction and build more homes faster at prices than Canadians can afford. Well, yes and no. I mean, construction costs are going to go up, but the cost of land is largely a huge swaying factor in the overall end cost that gets passed on to the consumer. We'll see how that goes. The federal government will use all tools available to convert public lands to housing, including leasing, acquiring other public lands for housing, and retaining ownership whenever possible. Keeping land under public ownership and leasing it to builders instead of selling to the highest bidder will enable new homes to be affordable forever, is the plan. This effort will help housing providers avoid unnecessary upfront capital costs, allowing them to build more affordable housing, all while strengthening the federal government's balance sheet to unlock more homes. Overall, again, good intentions, though, does this create wealth for those Canadians that want to have home ownership at some point? I'm not sure. We'll see. But again, something has to change. And this is at least a move that feels like it's progressive as opposed to, you know, like Dan said, taxing the demand side of the equation.
Yeah, the government here in Canada is by far the largest landowner in our country. And if they, let's say, convert some corporate land into essentially residential, well, that would definitely help, again, because sometimes we are largely landlocked, and this will help open up the potential for more housing, as long as we can find the people to build it. Okay, but let's talk about the infrastructure required to build these homes as well, because that's a big announcement that was kind of leaked early, because it's a big one, it's an important one. The budget includes $6 billion over the next 10 years to accelerate the construction and upgrading of housing-enabled water, wastewater, stormwater, and solid waste infrastructure that will unquestionably and directly enable new housing supply and help improve densification. Awesome. It's a big part of it. As we know, the amount, the cost for builders to tie into existing or having to install infrastructure is quite immense and can make or break a whole project. So this has the potential to help those builders. The fund is going to be allocated by releasing $1 billion right away to support the urgent infrastructure needs, and then $5 billion for agreements with provinces and territories to support their long-term priorities here. What does that mean? Well, there's a bit of a trade-off here, because they can access these funds if, there's an if here. Number one, the province has to commit to legalizing, apparently it's illegal now, legalizing more housing options by adopting the zoning that allows the 4 units as a right, and that permits for these missing middle homes, like obviously your duplexes, triplexes, townhouses, and whatnot, are approved. So it's kind of like what you're seeing happen in the province of BC. BC is apparently kind of leading this charge, if you will, and I believe the country has adopted the vision that Ken Sim and David Eby have put forth for our province. Essentially, every single family lot has to be instantly rezoned to allow up to, well, depending on the size, whatnot, 4, 5, 6 units, and so forth. So they have to do that. They also have to implement a 3-year freeze on increasing development charges. This is for municipalities and cities with a population greater than 300,000. I like this. Honestly, I think they should lower their development cost charges. But again, a freeze is a decent middle ground here. And I believe that will help bring houses to market as well. Number 3, the province must also adopt forthcoming changes to the National Building Code. Okay, well, this is interesting, and we don't know what this looks like yet, and hopefully this isn't a revert back to some silly ideas like what caused the leaky condos here in Vancouver, but we'll see how that passes through. Number 4, the province must provide pre-approval for construction of designs included in the government's upcoming housing design catalog. So we're going to touch on that. Basically, the government's going to say, hey, here's 50 home designs that we pre-approve, and you must adopt these and make them available to the people who want to build them. Last is the provinces must implement the measures from the forthcoming Homebuyers Bill of Rights and Renters Bill of Rights. We touched on this on a previous episode. It's largely garbage and useless, but the interesting one will be the National Rental Agreement, which makes no sense because these policies are made at a provincial level. So we don't need to dissect that because we don't know how it's going to wash out yet, but either way. Those are the measures that the provinces must adopt to have eligibility to access the $5 billion for infrastructure. I think BC will be all over this and move forward with it and hopefully be able to help fund some of the infrastructure that is so widely needed.
Yeah, and then there was an allocation from the budget towards innovating housing technologies. This means that there's $50 million going to research and development on how to innovate in construction. I think maybe modular homes and 3D printing. I've always been a fan of modular homes. They've got great quality control systems. They're built in a factory. They get assembled on site. It's a sure way of building more faster. And I think that's a great plan moving forward. There maybe needs to be some stigma removed from modular as well, but that's a whole other conversation. Overall, I think that's good. I don't know if $50 million is enough or not. I don't know what the results, how we're going to deem that a success or not, but nevertheless, it's positive. The housing design catalog, as Dan mentioned, $12 million for 50 designs of pre-approved homes. Would love to see when this is going to come out, because that'll be a big part of hitting the metrics that we've talked about earlier. So this should be at the forefront of coming out as early as possible. Hopefully, again, don't know if the $12 million is enough or not, but it sounds like it's a lot for 50 designs. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at $240,000 per design. So I can think of just a few architect friends I know that would jump at the opportunity to design a house for $240,000. Seems quite generous. But hey, it's not my industry specifically, so maybe I'm wrong. Please comment if that's well above or well below or right in line with the average architectural drawings for a home. Furthermore, and this one I like as well, there is going to be some money allocated towards secondary suites. So there's about $410 million that's going to be available over the next 4 years to launch what they're calling the Secondary Suite Loan Program. And this will enable current homeowners to access up to $40,000 in low interest loans to add secondary suites to their home. Again, right? How do you bring product to market? You lower the price of money, of loans, essentially. So this is somewhat good. I know in Alberta, a number of years back, they had a similar incentive. I believe it was free money. I think it was $30,000. Please correct me if I'm wrong here, but it was somewhere around that, 20 to 40 as well. Of a forgivable loan, essentially, that if you brought a secondary suite to market, the government was happy to give you that grant. And it had a lot of traction. I know a lot of investors especially love this one. They had a detached home, they added a suite, they provided extra rental housing. Again, this really only makes sense and it really only incentivizes people if this so-called Bill of Rights makes sense, right? We know today there are people that absolutely refuse to do something like this or will leave that current suite empty because, well, they know there's too many tenants out there who will come in, pay 1 month rent, and then just stop. And they will abuse the program. And they know they've got 12 to 18 months runway before they're even going to get in front of a tribunal. So why not live rent-free for that amount of time? Or screw over your landlord and get cash for keys, etc. Regardless, the idea here, again, I like it. It just has to be fair on both sides and further incentivize them, not just build a suite for someone who's going to take advantage of them.
That's a good point. Looking here at skilled workers, there's going to be 60,000 people that we're going to be short on in order, when it comes to construction trades by 2032 that we need to address. There's $100 million allocated for education and apprentice positions. Again, I'm not quite sure if that's the amount that makes sense or not. I know that if we're building something like 4 million homes, we're going to have a humongous shortage, but not only of construction trades, they've got to be qualified. It's going to take time for them to become qualified. So again, we'll see if they can deliver on this promise. I'm just not of the mind that it's possible. Having spent 10 years in the construction industry myself, I know what a difficult ask this can be.
Exactly. So that essentially wraps up the key points from the supply side that the government is focused on with this budget for 2024. They have, of course, also included some of the buyer side, some of the demand side benefits here as well. So let's take a look at those. Number one, the government has decided to create a plan to align the amount of immigration with home completions. This is incredible. Finally, a balance between supply and demand. I mean, amazing. It took until 2024 to realize they would need something like this, but there is a plan coming, so applaud that one, of course. They're also going to stabilize the foreign student intake numbers. Again, it took until the country was taken advantage of before they realized that they were exposed in that area. So they're trying to patch that hole now as well. I think we've touched on this one before, but they want the private sector now to allow people who are basically renters and people who are good renters and they pay the rent on time to have that affect their credit score to the positive. So you're asking all these mom and pops to not only report, but report correctly to the credit bureaus. Not sure if they're incentivized to do so, or you know what, you cash the check 5 days late and your tenant was being annoying, so you just, you know, make that report incorrectly. I think it opens up a massive can of worms and is not a good idea whatsoever. And you know, ultimately, how many clients have we had, Ryan, that are like, oh, I'd love to buy that home, but it's my credit score that's got me down. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost non-existent because a bad credit score goes with a lot of other things that probably got you there. That means you can't afford a home anyway. So ultimately, I don't think that element does much. But again, let's move on because it's kind of unimportant, if you will. So this one, again, a little bit of an interesting idea here. First-time home buyers to try to incentivize. Great. We know how hard it is to get into the market. So they, for first-time home buyers who are going to buy with less than 20% down, meaning they can buy with as little as 5% down if they're qualified, typically that means you're in an insured mortgage, which means you have a maximum of a 25-year amortization. Well, they're extending that amortization by 5 years up to 30 years now. Well, what does that mean? Typically about 8% buying power. So that extra 5 years equals an extra 8%. And for some people, that could mean being from out of the market to into the market. So largely, it's positive. But there's a twist here that I haven't quite wrapped my head around. It's only applicable for people who buy, quote unquote, new builds. Okay, so new builds are GST applicable. So you can only buy these homes that have that extra 5% off the top. Yes, you can put that in the mortgage, but there you go. So we're going to increase your buying power by 5%, sorry, 8%, but make sure you buy something that reduces it by 5%. Okay. Also, brand new builds, are we talking pre-sales? Because the vast majority of pre-sales, at least in BC, have a 20% down payment. So you're trying to help people who only have 5% down by giving them access to something that has 20% down. I guess it's talking about homes that have their pre-sales, but then they're completed, but no one's lived in them yet because they're still new, right? So they're still GST applicable. Again, you're helping just this tiny, tiny, tiny little segment of the marketplace. And it just seems there's too many bizarre stipulations here to make it have any type of mass adoption here. So again, it doesn't seem like the consultation was done there, but it will help a tiny few people. So I guess thanks for that. Lastly, moving along here, Ottawa is also proposing to increase the amount that first-time homebuyers can withdraw from their RRSP through that home buyer's plan. It used to be $35,000, now it's $60,000. That will help. That will help. I will share that I bought my first home using that exact same program many years ago, and it certainly helped me get into the market. So I'm clearly pro this. And also, they have slid in, I'm not sure if anybody caught this one, but they slid in the fact that they are extending the foreign buyer ban by an additional 2 years. It is now going out to 2027. So 0.9% of the marketplace is being told to stand by for a couple of years further.
Infinite wisdom. Unfortunately, I think this is kind of where things begin to take a turn in the budget. There's some positivity here. There was they took a swing at trying to do some things here that would hopefully help. Promising a lot. I'm not sure they're able to deliver on a bunch of it. But where this starts to get nasty is in the capital gains section here. So it's been over a lot of news articles. You've probably heard that the capital gains tax is going to be raised from 50% to a whopping 66.7%. Call it 67% for gains made over $250,000. And that's to ensure that the wealthy are paying their fair share of taxes. Though there's a number of different ways to curtail this, to not have to deal with it, and I'll touch on some of them in a little bit. However, let's talk about the immediate impacts. So if you're an investor right now and you have a secondary property and now you're staring down a 67% capital gain as opposed to a 50% capital gain, it could have a short-term impact on the marketplace. People who have held on to investments are now going to get dinged a lot more. And so in the short run, you could have or you could see an injection of housing supply as investors try and dump these units before they're going to get taxed a whole bunch more. We'll see. It's a tight window, and that's why they're implementing it in June 25th so that they can capitalize on it themselves. It will, not might, it will push out future investment out of our Canadian markets as investors will go to other markets where these capital gains are less or non-existent, further lowering our per capita GDP output. In Canada, it's going to make it harder for private industry to invest in things like housing projects, which we need. So it's kind of like shooting yourself in the foot here. You're saying, well, you know, we want to provide 4 million new homes, yet you're going to tax anyone who tries to do them even more. The changes in the treatment of capital gains are bound to distort incentives in the private sector and work against the one key source for supply side growth that Canada has been lacking for many years. What are those? Risk taking and capital deepening. What's more, these higher taxes will hurt Canadian competitiveness and investment at a time when productivity has flatlined and real per capita GDP and their incomes are in secular decay. Expect more people to be investing in things like dividend stocks or investments where they can pull capital gains out of the investment proportional to the tax regime that they find themselves in. You could see more interesting deals being made in the real estate sector. Take higher levels of creative financing, for example, and to avoid paying the tax. You know, we've done a number of deals where something called a vendor take-back mortgage is in place. And I think with higher levels of capital gains, you'll see higher levels of things like a vendor take-back mortgage. So instead, for example, of a buyer paying $2 million in lump sum for an asset they sell, sellers may be more interested in something that looks like a five-year deal that pays out their $2 million over that time period. Think of this. If I bought an investment for $1 million and then sold it for two, I've got a capital gain of $1 million. Now, instead of doing a deal where I'm going to get paid that $1 million up front, I'm going to, or that $1 million capital gains up front, I'm going to structure it in such a way where I'm going to get paid $1 million out of my $2 million. And then the balance, which is subject to capital gains, is going to be paid in $200,000 tranches over the next 5 years. So I don't hit that $250,000 minimum to pay my capital gains. It's a way of avoiding paying higher taxes, and I suspect you'll see more of things like this. This budget inherently causes more inflationary pressure as well. At a time when the government has been trying to curb public spending, think higher interest rates, to help bring prices down, at a time when families have been cutting spending and only deploying capital on items they need, our government sees fit to spend billions more instead of making cuts themselves. And they are choosing to fund their spending by increasing capital gains on the investments that you have made over the last 2, 5, 10, 20 years to help yourself get ahead. The government is reaching further into your pockets to take from you to pay for the incentives and provide you with so-called rebates that they deem appropriate. Why are we raising taxes and increasing spending at a time when the opposite should really be taking place? We have seen so much waste and so much abuse of spending power, in particular since the pandemic, that has me really concerned about how we're paying and why we're paying more taxes. And is that really going to change anything? How is it that we don't have major cuts in this budget that materially curb spending that's taken place by our government? Why are we increasing the burden on the Bank of Canada to not only manage the spending in the economy, but now having to consider the enormous spending that's going to be provided by the government? Don't think that this won't have an inflationary effect. Increasing the deficits to the levels that they are at now to make a correction, is going to make a correction and a future recession that much more difficult and that much more tough to get through. It's going to make it more severe. It also helps push the problems created by this government to the next generation or the next leadership group. I see it not only as irresponsible considering the state of our economy, but damaging. And the current government is blaming global issues for its poor local policy decisions. Our 2024 budget is making huge bets that everything goes well for the economy at a time when we are seeing a huge amount of global uncertainty. Especially having gone through the last 4 years, I've learned that we are constantly surrounded by uncertainty and therefore should have more slack in the ability to deal with that uncertainty than maybe what is presented in our budget, which is extremely tight.
Very well said, and thanks for wrapping that up. I think overall, the budget largely states that, look, housing is the most important thing. It's the most front of mind. They're finally starting to understand supply and demand dynamics are important and trying to make things a bit more of a level playing field. And they are now starting to promote and benefit and help the supply side, which is what we've kind of been trying to champion for years now, as it is so important. How it all pans out, again, we're going to watch, but at least the government has their focus on housing. I'd say it will continue to be the largest topic that most people are focused on and need to have improved over at least the next 5-6 years. So thanks as always for tuning in. Let's watch how this budget pans out. We will be here again for you next week with the most important topics affecting Vancouver real estate today.
That wraps up this edition of the Vancouver Life Podcast.
For more information on this podcast and to access a ton of free downloads, investment opportunities, current market info, and homes for sale, you can find it all at www.thevancouverlife.com.
Hanks, and we look forward to bringing you more podcasts about Vancouver real estate.